Welcome to the History of California podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. Some places refuse to sit still. They get built for one purpose, outlive it, get repurposed for the next, and outlive that too. Until what's left is a landscape you can't fully read without someone to hold your hand and walk you through it. The Presidio of San Francisco is exactly that place. Founded by the Spanish in 1776, it stood guard over the harbor of harbors under three different flags. Evolved from an adobe fort to a Cold War missile installation, and finally traded its guns in for the status of a magnificent national park. My guest today knows that ground better than almost anyone alive. John Langelier spent years as a historian, curator of the Presidio Army Museum, holds a PhD in military history from Kansas State, and has written more than 50 titles over a public history career spanning four decades. Much of it on the American West, the Buffalo Soldiers, and Spanish borderlands. He's also worked in film, presidential libraries, and at the Autry Museum, which means he thinks about the past not just as something to get right, but as something to make people feel. His new book, Bastion by the Bay, The Presidio of San Francisco, From the Outpost of Empire to Magnificent Park, is the culmination of a relationship with a place that stretches back 50 years. We cover a lot of ground in this episode. The strange business of consulting on Hollywood Westerns, what museums owe the public, whether history should make us uncomfortable, the Ohlone, the mission system, Russian otter hunters, a spectacularly botched centennial sham battle, and how a fortress bristling with nuclear warheads ended up mattering most for humanitarian reasons. John is generous, funny, deeply learned, and refreshingly unwilling to print the legend. I think you're going to enjoy this episode. Let's go meet John. John, I wanted to ask you, what was the theory of the West according to the show The Adventures of Ren 10-10?
The theory of, oh my God, Yo Renty is what I can remember, but
what was the West according to that show?
The West was strange. A bunch of white males with no women in a fort with a dog and a little boy.
Because I know that show was your first taste of the Western world and thinking about the West. I'm just curious in asking that question, kind of what ideas were formed in your mind from watching some of those early Western
books? Wide open spaces, obviously, adventure, a dog. Everybody wants a German Shepherd. I have a dog that's about 13 pounds, but he doesn't know he's not a German Shepherd. And frankly, because my father passed when I was 9 years old, it was a father figure show.
Okay. I'm curious, given your background and working in film and movies, what it's like to bring history as a profession to an entertainment industry.
I have a colleague who's a Roman Catholic priest, and he says he goes to Da Vinci Code for entertainment, not theology.
Yeah.
I think it's the same way with film. And being a consultant is like being a medical doctor. You tell the patient not to drink, smoke, eat a healthy diet, and then they go out, have a Big Mac and a beer and light up a stogie. It's in a rewarding field, but you keep going after it. And once in a while, you get a little piece of the action. And again, you realize that it is, after all, entertainment. And as a colleague of mine once said, by the name of Norman Lear, you can't preach to them until you get them into the synagogue. So if this is the way to get them into the synagogue, then that's fine with me. I started with They Died With Their Boots On and give annual tours of the Great Plains and the Dakota people and Custer and such. And this year we killed Custer, so I don't have to go back.
I think it's interesting. I just finished reading a review in the London Review of Books written by Emily Wilson, who's translated the Odyssey and the Iliad recently. And she was reviewing Christopher Nolan's Odyssey, which I just watched this last weekend. And she was scathing in a lot of his choices, and it felt tone deaf as to what the purpose of the activity is, which is to entertain. But I also respect film that tries its best to have some historical accuracy. I think a good film that I saw recently that did it well was called Two Prosecutors. I think it's a film from Romania, and it basically follows a prosecutor during the Stalinist purges of the 1930s. And so you'd follow him into a Soviet prison and watch him navigate through Soviet bureaucracy. And I felt like I was there. There's probably some historical inaccuracies, but for the most part, it was both entertaining and educational. Are there films that come to mind for you that strike that balance particularly well?
I think one of the few that really does is Lincoln.
Okay.
It was there to sell a product, but it was a pretty accurate product of this was a political maneuver, as was the Emancipation Proclamation and so much else that Lincoln did. He was, after all, an attorney and a politician, not a saint. But to get the job done, he realized that you sometimes have to wink, nod, and let some of the characters go off with a promissory note or to become a postmaster or an out-and-out bribe or what have you. And so I thought it did, and it was a powerful opening with an African-American soldier who better knew the Gettysburg Address than probably a lot of the people in the nation at that time. So it's like poetry. It's prose and poetry. There's poetry instills a feeling, and from that feeling sometimes may be more real than the reality. I'm not opposed to that.
Yeah. And I for me, adaptations, if we're just talking about the Odyssey, ones that the artist puts their own creative imprint on tend to be my favorites. Orson Welles doing Shakespeare, whatever it is. Those are not the strict adaptations, the BBC version of Great Expectations. It's good in its own way, but I want an artistic statement if I can. Let me ask you about another thing. You've had such a fascinating career and have done so many different things. I can't help but ask. What's involved in working on a Buffalo Soldier stamp portfolio for the U.S. Postal Service? What does that entail? I read that and I was like, what does that look like? Is that curating art and trying to craft a scene for a postal stamp, or what is it involved?
Essentially, it was give a context to the stamp. The stamp was already set in concrete, or in this case, in bronze. It was using the inspiration of the new Buffalo Soldier, at that time, the new Buffalo Soldier Memorial being dedicated at Fort Leavenworth, essentially one of the early homes of the 10th Cavalry, and on the spot where they were essentially isolated from the white garrison because the white commanding officer didn't want to have his troops tainted by these real soldiers, at any rate. So the artwork was set in place, but to give it the context to say who these individuals were in a more accurate sense of where they served, what they did, what their mission was, some of their challenges, the old WB. I had the wonderful opportunity Friday and Saturday to be with a 100-year-old Buffalo soldier who had
Really?
served in Italy and was wounded, and along with numerous other African Americans and many who were still in national cemeteries in Italy and elsewhere. And things hadn't changed too much in 1944 from 1866. So basically, it was to give a context and some sort of sense of historical reality, as opposed, there's a lot of myth making, and I understand that, to swing the pendulum to the other side. But it's time now that we don't have to be the man who shot Liberty to balance and print the legend. We can have the legend and enjoy it, and then hopefully learn from the actuality of what did happen.
I have to ask a few questions about museums. I find myself working in public history and trying to connect listeners to great academic research and even popular history so they have a better understanding of the past. And I know that you've worked in museums over the course of your career, and I spend a lot of time in them. I was actually in London a few weeks ago, and whenever I'm there, I always make an effort to get over to the British Museum, both because it's beautiful on the inside, but because through a long history of imperialism, they have some of the most incredible artifacts to be seen anywhere. I remember I was walking through an exhibit that was focused on Chinese history, and there was just loads and loads of Chinese tourists taking pictures with their iPhones of Chinese historical artifacts. And it's just like nowhere else in the world are you going to have some kind of experience like that. So I'm curious about philosophically, I know Tony Bennett has argued that the public museum was invented as a tool for shaping citizens, not just storing artifacts. Do you think we're doing a good job of that right now in our museum culture?
I think we are attempting to shape citizens, and we have a counter movement to unshape the citizens to a story that is more convenient to the individual trying to make the counter argument. And I think counter arguments are important. I happen to work in the presidential library system, And seldom will you go into a presidential library and say, oh, this was a terrible thing that this person did. Let's use an example of Theodore Roosevelt. As a youth, he was one of my heroes, the great outdoorsman, conservation individual, who decided after he had the black vote won to turn aside those folks who got him into to the executive mansion, and to a degree, that is the black soldier, and have a whole battalion of black soldiers in 1906 essentially dismissed without honor because it was a lot easier to do it that way. Believe it or not, there was ballistic material in 1906 that disproved that these soldiers were guilty, but no one knew about ballistics and much less than they did about, except for Sherlock Holmes, about fingerprinting and other forensic situations. And so there's the good, the bad, and the ugly. And if libraries, museums do portray that, and even controversially stay in a situation of an art museum, some art may be offensive to some and embraced by others, but I think we have to be open, and the public needs to vote with its feet. They need to go there and not come back or continue to come back, because they are imprinting themselves on that and taking it away. Again, to me, you need to get them into the synagogue before you can preach. Mm-hmm. But what the sermon is for the day has to be weighed by the parishioners, by the congregation.
Well, that kind of taps into my next question, which was about a critique. We have a distrust of experts in our society right now due to political forces, due to the internet, due to Twitter, due to whatever. And so there's been a long kind of standing critique that there's this quote unquote authorized voice that's given the prestige of determining what counts as significant in museums. And this kind of critique, part of the basis of it is that the community needs to have an interpretive influence in some capacity. Now, what exactly that looks like, I don't know. I don't want to crowdsource my captions for artwork. That seems crazy. But where do you sit in that kind of spectrum between a distant authorized academic voice and then the community and their own stories associated with something? So for example, in my local art museum in Fresno, there's a lot of beautiful basket artwork from Yokuts tribes near where I lived and then or where I live currently. And who decides what should be said about artifacts seems like a political debate, but it also seems complicated because we do need experts.
There has to be cross-pollinization. NAPRA is, I think, one of those great things that says you just don't go and let's go back to the great Imperial British Museum. Oh, I say, let's take these stones off this Parthenon. These Greek people don't even speak English, understand it better than that. And maybe a Zulu shield here and something from somewhere else. So it was the great raping and pillaging and burning. It wasn't, the monument men were not around during Victoria's time. And yet those things have been preserved, and many things have been lost in war. And for other reasons, because societies have decided to burn books or do other things. So there has to be a balance. But there's a voice, there's an auteur in everything you do, whether it's a book, movie, an exhibit, what art you choose, what art you elect not to use, even in a zoological sense. What animals, what specimens? Is it the flora and fauna of an area, or is it just because this is really cool and everybody wants to see the giant elephant or the giraffe or what have you? So there's always someone dictating to us what we're going to see, whether it's in any of these genres, because even though it's the Kunstkammer, not just for the prince now, the prince is opening up the palace for us to come in and see his Fabergé eggs or whatever the case may be. So there has to be a balance, and yet it can't be chaos. I come in, you partake of it, and then hopefully you go home and it's like an amuse-bouche at a nice meal. You've had a little champagne and an amuse-bouche, and then you go home and decide to make your own meal. That's perhaps a little bit more satisfying and realistic. But you went back to the important point. The input of individuals, those people who made those baskets, there is a soul to those baskets. There is a culture to those. And so people of that culture, no matter what that culture may be, need to have an input. You were going back to the stamp, an African-American, a Buffalo Soldier stamp. Here's a French-Canadian person being engaged by the Postal Service to be their, quote, expert. I've spent now 50 years on the trail of the Buffalo Soldiers, and I've come to one conclusion. I know very little about the topic. I know more and more about the topic, but in essence, I wasn't there. I can't put myself 100% into those places. And that's what's necessary, I think, to have that public input. There's also a danger to that because we're mythically predisposed to, again, my days with the NBA, I look at fondly, even though it never happened. I was tall and handsome and sought after by the Knicks and the Lakers and everybody else. And I turned them all down to be a historian because that's where the real money is. Historians and museum curators are fabulously wealthy. So there has to be that balance. And yet someone has to take the lead and suffer the consequences if that's the wrong lead. It's like a military officer. You lead from the front, but you may be the first one shot, or you may be shot from the back and fragged like in Vietnam because you're a terrible leader. But someone has to take the lead, but that doesn't abrogate the responsibility of the public to respond.
Yeah, that's a great point. The other thing I wanted to broach around museums, and this is really centering it in the current political debate, which is uncomfortable history. Sharon McDonald published a great book called Difficult Heritage, and it looks at Nuremberg and how Nazi past was addressed in different ways and how it's evolved over time. But it feels like we're increasingly seeing this bifurcation into only telling happy stories and then only telling sad stories with the respective polarized ends of our political spectrum on either side. And it feels like we need something that's a bit more nuanced. But I do think, given that what the people in power right now are the ones that want to sanitize some of the darker stuff, I think it's worth asking, what is the value of telling stories that make people uncomfortable in a museum format? So what would you say? Is part of museums' missions to make people a little bit uncomfortable?
I think people, you could be uncomfortable by going to a zoo because while the five-year-old is warm and fuzzy, the rest of us go, these animals are becoming extinct because we're destroying habitat and we've imprisoned what is left of whatever the specimen is. And so even the happy places don't, there's no real Disneyland in this world, regardless of, and I've worked for the Disney, so I can assure you that's the case. But having said that, to purposely make people uncomfortable without a point, without a goal or reason is, I think, deficient in worth as it is to say, only tell the stories that Mickey and Minnie want you to hear. Because there's always a Donald Duck out there who's not the greatest in the world. Maybe the Donald Duck, who knows? But I think there is value to it as long as it's not done for the sake of shock, really. Is it done for the sake of, again, promoting dialogue? And I think that's what's lacking is dialogue. And it's whether it happens in museums or on either side of the aisle, in the House and the Senate, or in the city council and our local communities, because all politics, let's face it, are local anyway. And I contend all history is essentially starts locally and then moves out. If you write a military history, and a good point was made by the gentleman who was in Italy the other day, he knew what the guy on one side and the other side was doing. He didn't know what the general or anybody else was doing.
Yeah.
And most of us, that's the way we view life. And so if somebody tries to put together the long line of the fellows and the ladies and the gentlemen on either side of us. But being uncomfortable, it makes us uncomfortable to think and to say, why did this happen? Did it need to happen? And is it continuing to be the same situation? And if it is, how do I prevent that? If I really truly care about being a good citizen, meaning taking care of everyone and not just myself and my small group in the foxhole on either side of me.
One more question about museums before we jump into your book. I have some friends from England that I'm planning to take to the Autry Museum when I show them around Los Angeles. The Autry Museum is fantastic, but not as well known as it should be. Can you describe for people, because I've had friends from LA that they've lived there most of their lives. Told me they didn't know about the Autry Museum. Can you describe what it is, what it has, and why people should visit?
We'll circle back to that very same question about the Presidio when we get there, because I have a story that is true that is the same thing. Starting out when Mr. Autry decided to do this, the boss man, who was one of I've had incredible people in the military and elsewhere that I worked with and for. I've never met a guy who what you saw on screen is what just what you got. He was quite extraordinary. He put his money where his mouth was, literally millions of his own dollars. But people thought it was going to be another one of those singing cowboy type of museums like the one in Victorville, which was great and fun. And for those of us who watched all those westerns in the 50s, eating our bowl of Wheaties or what have you,
Walking
that was
around with
great.
player pianos and fake pistols. Yeah.
Exactly. But in this particular case, it was a challenge, particularly from the academic community. Oh my, here goes another cowboy museum showing off his cat pistols and his and all his merchandise. I only had one, to get back, I'll circle back to your question, but I only had one or two dialogues with him about something. One of it was because he was an astute businessman. Are we getting our money's worth on a particular project? That's a great, since it's his money, he's the taxpayer in this case, although it was completely private. That was a good question to ask. But more importantly, one day I was doing some video work because my offices were at Disney, and I ran something by him. It was about the singing cowboys and their evolution and such. And he was really upset that there was too much about him and began to rattle off a list of singing cowboys, including Herb Jeffries, the bronze buckaroo, the African American singing cowboy. That here I thought I was pretty astute about African American history, and I you're in the headlight. So I had to throw everything back, and you didn't get your money's worth out of this one, sir, because I sat in an edit booth for weeks and weeks to do this, and it wasn't what you wanted because it wasn't what it should have been. Yes, the Autry itself has an extraordinary slice of material. Object-wise, it was well curated. The Nottages were a very professional couple that came from Kansas, having started the Kansas Historical Museum, and it was the state-of-the-art museum in the 80s. And so the Autrys, again, being very astute business people, wanted people who understood the bricks and the mortar, but also had a sound curatorial background. And then they assembled historians that had a wide range of information. My background is Spanish colonial history, amongst other things. My first PhD program was with Francis Paul Pruka and Native American relations with government, particularly the US government. So we try to assemble a number of people, but again, encyclopedic as it may be, you can't put everything into the shoebox. And I have not been there for years, so I'm not sure if they have fallen to we don't do anything new anymore, don't change anything till Gene comes back, or if they've done new programming and such. And programming was also a key there. It was not only assembling incredible collections from a very generous person, but having programming that sometimes was fun and just entertaining, and other times had people provoked to have to come up with an opinion of their own, good, bad, or indifferent to it. Its location is phenomenal. It's the fact that he had to fight again for that locale. But we go to malls, as much as I hate them, we go to malls because the convenience of everything under one roof until Amazon and other people came into being. But it's the same thing. Now you have a great area to go for the zoo and numerous other things. And of course, at one time, that was Mr. Disney's idea of having his railroad extravaganza there that morphed into something slightly larger, the Disney empire of Disneyland, Disney World. I guess there's one in France too. I never went. I was too busy looking for wineries in France than when I lived there than another Disney experience, but shame on me. So.
I was actually just talking to someone this morning that went to the Disneyland in Paris and said it was strange because it was like a miniature Paris and he was in Paris. Stephen Aaron over there at the Autry Museum is carrying it in positive directions. He's a previous guest of the show, and I'm hopeful that we continue to have vigorous Western museums that have great content because it's an important part of our history. Now, I want to jump into your book now, and I want to ask first, what piqued your interest in writing about the Presidio?
Obviously, that is a Presidio, not the Presidio.
Yeah, a Presidio. Yes. Sorry. That's a San Francisco
No,
inflection, is
no,
what that
no,
is. A
no.
Presidio.
But no, I'm glad. No, but no, I'm glad you opened up that way, because if I turned the screen off right now and got in my car in 14 minutes, I can be at one Presidio, the Presidio of San Agustin de Tusum, And again, in another hour and a half, and you can come join me at an incredible Mexican restaurant with a super wine list in Tuba, which is another presidio. Presidios simply were a throwback to the old presidium, the Roman idea of come to an area, conquer it, and make sure that no one gets out of hand. We build a fort and put troops in it. And then everybody's happy because the Romans are here to stay and they've made it known. So I've known about presidios literally since my childhood, living here in Arizona since I was 5 years old. And so it was nothing foreign to me as an aspect. And actually, studying Spanish colonial history and going to the University of San Diego, where there's another presidio, as a matter of fact, the first in Alta California, at least, in a beautiful park-like setting, it was something that was not foreign to me when a job was available in San Francisco. And I had never been to San Francisco, so I went for a job interview. And surprisingly, having talked to the post commander, who was an old cavalry officer, retooled, getting ready to retire, I contradicted him on something. I thought, there just went your first idea for a job, but you have to go back for your doctoral program anyway and teach your classes on Spanish colonial history this fall, so better get home and start finishing up your lectures. Needless to say, by the end of the day, I had a job offer, which I never thought would happen. And so it was a fairly important situation. Okay, I'm here. I'm starting a brand new museum. There's a building that's empty with a unlikely artifacts to be used. They were just taken by some people who thought they were doing the right thing. I need, as I do in historical archaeology or historic preservation, I need the underpinning story to be able to go into the archaeological excavation or to the restoration and preservation of a structure. And in this particular case, one thing is like I'm doing the thread on your sweater. I'll just pull that thread. Oh my God, pretty soon there's a pile of wool on the floor that I have to re-knit now. There were some existing materials, and luckily the Bancroft Library is phenomenal. And in the day, there the Pioneer Society, the California Pioneers, and the California Historical Society were absolutely great treasures. Some materials in the National Archives, and there was stuff stockpiled all over the Presidio because the Presidio, for all intents and purposes, had never really been abandoned in the Spanish colonial Mexican period. But during the U.S. period, people had saved things to the degree that my building, that was my office, was built in 1863 as the second post hospital. And I went up into the attic one day for, I have no idea, probably for some structural issues because I'm concerned as most of us are in the world of retrofitting buildings that we preserve them as much as we use them for other utilizations. And so I found people had squirrel things in the floorboards upstairs, letters and uniform material and all sorts of paraphernalia, so that it was a living archaeological site that needed material to help interpret its meaning, literally dating back to the Spanish colonial period. And there was a good fortune too. Jose Antonio Urbina, Senor Urbina, was the consul general at the time from Spain, and it was getting to be about the time of the bicentennial, and he was fascinated that someone was interested in the Spanish, and as a matter of fact, one of the major battles that saved the Mississippi was with Spanish arms at Fort St. Louis along the river there. But having said that, I would just simply mention things when we would meet at various functions, and 3 weeks later, some lieutenant general sitting in Sevilla or Madrid or elsewhere would send you a large sheaf of material that after you got through, oh, senor, you are so wonderful. And I beg to you to indulge me for 45 minutes of your time. And then, okay, I need some muskets. And I haven't been paid for 3 years. Could we maybe, get some money? So it was a great deal of fun. It was like assembling all these people. It was a treasure hunt. It was a treasure hunt. And I had enthusiastic support from the military garrison, from many people in California. Now, I cheated a little bit. The head of the archives at the California Historical Society was one of my classmates at the University of San Diego. One of the head archivists for the state of California was my roommate at the University of San Diego. So there was a small military, small history mafia around to support this military venture. And so that was the long and the short of it. And when the Army had offered me the opportunity to take a year off to go back and re-jumpstart my doctoral program, I decided I owe them. They're sending me here. They need a document that they, and then the Park Service, which was constantly expanding from its Fort Point under the bridge that wonderful art that Strauss, the architecture, said, I can't destroy this wonderful piece of architecture. I'll build an arch that doesn't have to be there, but I don't want a big concrete pylon there instead, which would have been probably more effective in terms of cost effectiveness. But that was the reason for it, is I felt that I've assembled this material. These people deserve everything they've done for me, all the kindnesses they've shown me. And I'd like to leave something behind that could be used. Ironically, of course, it wouldn't be used that much longer because the Presidio Army Museum would close with the base closure and the coming of the National Park Service expanding the Golden Gate National Recreation Area to numerous other sites, including the Presidio itself.
Okay, let's jump into some of that material that you've collected over time. Before there was a Presidio, there was the Ohlone. There was people living on the San Francisco Peninsula. Probably more than any other topic on the history of this podcast show, the mission system has been the one that's had the most hand-wringing, the most discussion, the most nuanced conversations, because it's complex. It's conquest, it's violence, it's cooperation, it's a lot of things all at once. So when you were thinking about how you wanted to frame the mission system in your book, what were the kinds of influences and perspectives you wanted to bring to this kind of really fraught topic?
I unfortunately had a Monsignor who was never very happy with me, we'll go on, named about my perspective. I was in the Catholic seminary. I have gone from parochial school from when I was in second grade to my first PhD program in Catholic universities under these folks, particularly known as the Jesuits. Somebody might have heard of them. They were not in Upper California. They were not in Alta California. By then, the king got wise that these guys are more powerful than my army. But at any rate, it is a topic fraught. It is, as much as I'm not an embracer of settler colonialism, because it's, I'm afraid, like my hero, Frederick Jackson Turner, it's only one way to frame the perspective, but it's not the only way that will give us the kaleidoscope of what's going on as well as we can at the distance of 200 or 300 years. So California was a wonderfully rich, complex societies, plural, and I had the good fortune to write a small chapter in a book that was the only book I ever saw that sold more than three copies and wasn't remaindered 6 months after it came off the press. But anyway, that's because I was only one author and there were a lot of real authors on it, but it forced me to go back and look at the diversity of languages, cultures, aspects of California history, and a rather more peaceful coexistence than you would find, say, in if I went out to this same period of time of the 1700s, and Diné and Indé and Navajo and Apache isn't going to be a friend to the Odom. As a matter of fact, we're going to steal as much as we can from you. And now that you've embraced the missions and have crops and sheep and other things, we're going to steal everything we can that's not nailed down from you. So there wasn't peaceful coexistence. It wasn't a kumbaya time. California, more so, it was a more cohesive grouping of people. Probably that's one of the reasons why the 21 missions, in certain respects, were more successful, to use a loaded term. It was easier to bring somebody in who were the people living along the bay in 1776 than it would be to walk up to an Apache in his wikihup and try and convince him that I'm in my gray robe and I have some beads to give you, and I'm sure you'll love my way of life. And so it was, the people were open to this new religion, obviously, but they were also open to new diseases and to things such as soldiers who weren't always the most friendly individual to the indigenous peoples. And so it was a complex situation. And ultimately, the military in California, unlike the Presidios in most places, while they did have a role in subduing the local peoples, that was not the hardest job in the world, except for 1769, after when the Father Jaime was killed in an outbreak of, hey, we've had enough of this stuff. So these aren't just people sitting around docilely and saying, we can't do anything for ourselves as well as us. No, we have the ability to strike back. And frankly, we have the superior numbers. And we've lived a long time without these people, with their strange languages and customs. And their metal we like, everything else, not so much. So it was a complex situation. But the reality was, it was layered and layered. And there's been some brilliant work, unfortunately not by me, but as you notice in the opening chapters, some brilliant work on the archaeological background and the complex relationships at the Presidio, which was not so much different than the relationships at any of one of the Franciscan missions.
Can you also give for us a picture of the geopolitics of the Presidio, Russians chasing Pelts and whatnot? It's there's a bigger dimension to its role, and I'd love for you to unpack that for us.
I think that was one of the things that really intrigued me the most about this Presidio. The rest of them are kind of cookie cutters. I could fill in the blank of, I got a Moraga here, I got an Anza there, but you change some of the characters' names, but it's the same movie and scenario. And yeah, we're here to open up the Statis Comanches, or the Kiowas, or whoever the enemy du jour is, who's frankly more powerful than you are, and you're not doing a very good job. And you figure out, how do you say treaty and Comanche? What do we give them to stop having them burn down our places and such? But it took, even the Texas Rangers can't do that. And if a Texan can't do it, who can?
Not a single
person. We won't go there, I promise. at any rate, I found that the most fascinating thing about the California, it was paranoia. It was paranoia too about the French and coming in and encroaching from Louisiana, even though they're Bourbons on both thrones. I don't trust my cousin. Why would you trust a Frenchman, for gosh sakes? I'm French, I know. You don't trust those people, but they have good wine. But they do in Spain too. So we have to say that these people did bad things, but they brought grapes and vineyards that we can all enjoy today. But having said that, it was the Russians are coming. And if you and I were doing a documentary on this, how wonderful in the story arc from the Russians are coming to the Russians are coming, but we have to have missiles to stop these people, to maybe Gorbachev will come and set up a peace society here, and we'll all be together singing hand in Russian and in English, how lovely we are. But yes, it is those very terrible people coming from the Muscovites with their strange religions. They make the sign of the cross the wrong way and all these things. We have to stop them. And in the long run, they bring us here, but somehow they help us survive because we don't have some of the craftsmen and some of the things we need. And so we now, maybe if you guys take a few otters, we won't care, because what are we going to do with them? We're more interested in our cattle anyway when the Yankees come. That's a bigger trade, illegal trade. And again, it's a mercantilist society. Everything is held by the crown. So everything that goes on is supposedly to be halted. And in reality, because we've extended far beyond. We go all the way up to Nootka, if we're Spanish, all the way up to where Canada is. I guess looking for Molson, I'm not sure why they would go there otherwise. But having said that, if you've overextended this vast empire, as all empires find out, whether the Spanish, the British, or the Romans before them, that these empires eventually topple because the infrastructure cannot be supported in a day and age, particularly when there's communication is more. Lines of communication, both in terms of being able to communicate information and to keep supply, and the most important thing, the golden rule. The king with the gold rules. And even the Spanish, even though they had ripped off most of the great gold and silver to take back to Spain from New Spain and elsewhere, ultimately it was a house of cards and not a house made of golden bricks. And so that Russian incursion really started something that ultimately someone else, it is, as Father Font would say, the harbor of harbors. If it wasn't the Russians, it was the British. And if it wasn't the British, it would be those nasty guys from Boston, those Yankees.
Yes. I have to say, probably my favorite part of your book, and we're skipping a little ahead now, is a ill-begotten military demonstration that took place to celebrate 100 years. It's kind of funny, Trump's carnival to celebrate the 250th. Reminded, it kind of had parallels where there's a lot of positive intent and then kind of something that fell flat. So if you wouldn't mind, just in broad strokes, give us an overview of what happened in 1876 in San Francisco's Presidio.
Of course, by 1876, the population of San Francisco in general, not completely, had forgotten that while somebody was sitting there trying to scratch out lines like, oh, we can't have that about slavery in this document because, oh my God, those people in Virginia, what are we going to do? We'll have to do our own work. So we bypassed everything that was historical and could have been explored because we're showing the taxpayer that the mighty U.S. Army, with all these forts on Alcatraz and Angel Island and the Presidio and the headlands that we're constantly wrangling over to try and get the land as under eminent domain or whatever reasons they're in the courts, we're going to show these people that their money was well spent and they can go to bed every night safe and sound in San Francisco. And so they had the sham battle. Now, sham, as we all know, has multiple meanings, as many other words do. Sham might be make-believe, or sham might be taken as something that is totally bogus and untenable. And that's what happened. The great artillery forces began to fire at pretend targets out there floating around rafts and missing. And some old man says, if I was a kid, I'd just go out there and sit there. It's the safest place in San Francisco. So it probably wasn't the finest hour to celebrate our centennial. Maybe it was a lot of fireworks. And I'm sure that there was some partaking of wine and other spirits, because San Francisco, I know you're going to be shocked, but had many saloons. And that was, and why, if God was punishing San Francisco in 1906, did it burn down churches and leave some of the whiskey distilleries? There's the really important theological question for another time. But having said that, it was a farce. It was a sham. It did bring home one point. The government had been trying to get by on government surplus, the building and the old style of brick fortifications, not unlike the third system fort of that magnificent Fort Winfield Scott or Fort Point, as we know, under the bridge. And so going back to the drawing board, ultimately, it would take years and years, but the government, Congress, ultimately began to devote funds for more modern coastal offenses, both in terms of brutalism type of architecture before there was brutalism, the concrete batteries, but also brand new propellants, brand new artillery pieces, not unlike Krupp would be turning out and elsewhere in Germany and also in England and such, and beginning to look at even things like our friend Edison said, I can defend San Francisco with electricity. Or my favorite piece, the pneumatic dynamite gun. Hot air, which should have all of Congress come out to fire the gun for them, but it was an air-propelled thing. Pumping up an old Daisy rifle, if you don't have it pumped up enough, how far does the BB go? So when you're firing dynamite out one end from the other end that you've just put it in, it might have not been the most practical thing, but it sounded like a good idea at the time.
Yeah, if we fast forward now, There's a great irony in your book of the Endicott Board and all the military buildup, the neglect of our coastal defense systems, and then the irony that the Presidio was more important for humanitarian reasons than military reasons, even though we had invested in all this infrastructure. I guess my question is, where did that anxiety come from, that the worry, the concern that led to that? I know that there was some, I don't even know if we could call them skirmishes with Spain in the 1870s and 1880s that led to some general anxiety. But why did we invest so much money in the Presidio? Where did that anxiety come from?
One of my favorite things that have ever been uttered from an occupant of the Oval Office was the military-industrial complex.
Okay.
San Francisco, the Golden Gate, represented more than just a mythical, the Golden Horn, and eventually the bridge. It was from the period of the 1840s forward, it was an economic engine, the Great Harbor and all the resources, whether it's the Redwoods of California, et cetera, or going back to the Otter before that, all those resources had to be protected. It was an economic interest through the country. It was also part of an almost, to me, going back to settler colonialism, I think settler colonialism is just a new way for academics to be able to spin something that we used to call manifest destiny. While I don't embrace it, I do understand that this was almost a near, going back to the Spanish missionaries. A Spanish soldier might have had a different reason. It might have been more glory and gold than God. But for most of the Spanish missionaries, and for many Americans, it was almost, we have the God-given not only right, but requirement to proselytize and bring our way of life to the benighted everybody's. And the benighted everybody's don't always have to be the native peoples that we brush aside or put on reservations. They can be people who speak Spanish. They can be many other people that we have to show that we are the city on the hill. We're bringing the white with us. And so it's kind of a mission, but it's also an economic background. And so San Francisco has to be looked at in that way. You'll notice that most of the other places at this time, Los Angeles and San Diego, are not really that much in the equation. There's some work being done, and later on there will be as the Pacific, when we do our jump from manifest destiny and becoming a frontier constabulary to an imperial international power in 1898 forward. Then we'll start looking more at San Diego. The Spanish tried early on to do something there. We haphazardly built some things at Point Lomas and some things that ultimately that came to be in Los Angeles. But Los Angeles was not the big prize, nor was San Diego. It was for numerous economic and sociopolitical reasons, San Francisco. And so the money was spent there, whether it was well spent is another question, although it gave us a wonderful petting zoo of the history of, as one of my professors, Dr. Robin Heim, used to say, the wave theory of military. You build something, so I build a counter thing. You build a counter to my counter, I build a counter to your counter. And it keeps going on and on, whether it's aviation or Endicott versus Taft, or whether it's muzzle loading versus breech loading or what have you. And so it's a constant one-upsmanship till by the 1970s, of course, we are now knowing that there's ships aren't going to come over the horizon, and we're not going to shoot something as big as a Volkswagen 20 miles out towards the Farallones. It's going to be a heavy bomber that's going to come over, or a missile from somewhere, and not an invasion fleet. And it's not going to be Pearl Harbor again, which we were not prepared for in San Francisco, obviously, in December of 1941.
Yeah, it's surprising to me. I didn't know about missile placement in the Presidio during the Cold War. That's not a history that I was familiar with. How did San Francisco think about having a military installation with missiles just up the road? Was that a topic of discussion in the city politically or anything like that? Or what was there any blow from this?
No, particularly in Berkeley, they were very happy to have.
Yes. I was more referencing the establishment, how the establishment, I guess, perceived.
Yes, the establishment, of course, was the establishment. It's during the period of after Korea that we're doing these builds up and going into Vietnam. And, of course, Vietnam becomes a major impact, not only from the standpoint of the war being essentially looked at places like Berkeley and people marching in Golden Gate Park and elsewhere. And yet troops are coming and going constantly from San Francisco. The new Letterman Hospital is built in many respects to handle the ever-increasing number of casualties coming back from Southeast Asia. And there were sites that, because missile sites aren't just like the old coastal artillery emplacement, the gun is there and 20 yards away of somebody in a tower with their range finders and all that stuff. We have sites all the way over in the Berkeley area and such, to have this whole system, because it's an electronic system. It's, yes, it's pre-computer, but it's a far jump from the old line of sight firing of artillery pieces of an earlier time. And so this was not well disposed by many people, and understandably, because of the blowback against the war, the Presidio was a heavy symbol of that expansion of the American military forces. And in this particular case, the anti-war movement saying, this is, to St. Augustine, this is not a just war. And so it was, the site of the Presidio was highly symbolic. And certainly, to a certain degree, with the end of the Cold War, the rapidly decreasing need for things like the missile sites and such played into the hands, or not played into the hands, but worked into the scenario. Why do we need these military people here? Of course, now that all the economic impact happens after the fact, people go, maybe it wasn't moral, but it certainly was monetarily a very good thing. It brought huge amounts of money into the area. And the underlying situation that had long since, and as you read the book, found that they were cognizant even in the period not long after the Civil Wars. People envied real estate in San Francisco, if you can believe that. And that was a prime place for real estate for the people up on Nob Hill and such to expand to some nice painted ladies, some Victorians and such. And so the land was often looked at as a great area for development, fortunately, because of legislation and the coming of the Golden Gate National Recreation Area, that development was staved off. And even though, as you also learned in the book, that there were some naysayers in the National Park Service. Oh my God, we can't. This is not a real park. It's in a city. You can't have a park in a city. Let's face it, those people in New York City are benighted. They have a park, but that's not a real park. And it was, the fear was, take away from our real parks where we can wear our Smokey the Bear hats and our little arrowhead insignia. Real parks are wonderful, but they're all real parks. And a kid living in the South Mission, chances are, isn't going to get to Yosemite or Sequoia per se, but he or she hopefully will get to the Presidio and the Headlands. And the first real park in the area is actually Angel Islands. It's a state park, which is still one of my favorite places to visit when I'm in the Bay Area. It's another world by just a simple few minutes away by the only way you can get there by a ferry.
Yeah. To kind of wrap up, I wanted to ask you, let's say you're advising a friend who's visiting San Francisco for the first time, and they said, yeah, I'll go to the Presidio for an afternoon. So I don't have much time, but they maybe want to see something of interest. What would you recommend to someone that has an afternoon to kill in the Presidio?
Definitely start at Fort Point underneath the Golden Gate Bridge, which is embodied. It collapses everything down because much of the Presidio today is difficult to understand without somebody to hold your hand and interpret, because there's so many, it's above ground archaeology, as I've alluded to. And so without somebody trying to help you decipher these things, start at that beach area where the original people would go down in their balsa canoes and started their lives and had their families. And if you start at that juncture and you can see out to the Farallones and you can see into the magnificent harbor with the Angel Island and Alcatraz and Yerba Buena, now Treasure Island, I would start there. That's probably your best bet for being able to come and understand a bit about the numerous generations of people. And it's about people. I tried the most as I could. I'm not a very good academic historian because I don't do all the wonderful analysis that very scholarly historians do. I'm more concerned about the people who lived there in the past. Also, some nostalgia. I married at the Presidio. I had some great friends there. Matter of fact, my fantastic mentor, in a way, even though he and I worked together and he was my junior in terms of age, Dr. Don Abenheim, you know, never a gun fired in anger was Don's situation. All this buildup for no reason. And yet maybe the real reason was, as you said, the humanitarian, not only to bring in people from Vietnam, to bring in people from the 1906 earthquake and the devastating fire, more important in some respects than the earthquake in terms of the needs for shelter and medical and other situations, but also to preserve this magnificent national park that is easily accessible and can be parsed in numerous ways. If you get there just once, you need to keep coming back because there are other parts of the story. So when I watch Casablanca, every time I watch Casablanca, I get another line, another nuance. So it's the same way there. And to go back to what you were saying earlier about your colleagues at the Autry, I had a very elegant lady come up one day and with a driver in a Rolls Royce with white gloves and a hat, and came up the stairs and said to me, "Sir, I've lived in San Francisco all my life, and we have for many generations. What is the Presidio?" I think that's a question that still I can't completely answer, but I tried to do so to a certain degree in the book. And I'm hoping maybe once in a while somebody will read the book and go, "You made a lot of errors, or you left a lot of things out, and there's still many things to be explored here."
Yeah, it's definitely a book that inspires you to want to learn more. I want to conclude this podcast with the book recommendations, my favorite section. What are a few books you'd like to recommend to listeners, either about something we've discussed or books that are important to you that are related to California?
Boy, I'm kind of old school. There's Anything in the Old Days by Herbert Eugene Bolton, the old Spanish colonialist that kind of underpinned everything. That's still, his work is still very important. If you look in some of my footnotes, there are some excellent pieces by a colleague who's in the at Berkeley in anthropology department. Exceedingly important to understand how San Francisco and California was developed and changed. Those works, so go back to the bibliography. I always read footnotes and bibliographies before I read text, and then I'll decide whether. And then the old works of Bancroft. They were just a mass assembly without sorting out anything that was what was important or not. But they're still worth looking at, some of the old Bancroft works. And so much of that now is online. I would suggest that. And this is shameless, but there was a fantastic individual by the name of Dan Rosen, who back in the 1950s was a non-commissioned officer who later on went to teach across the bay in Oakland. And he and I did a book called El Presidio de San Francisco. And it's still, I think, a readable book for people who want to really dig down to the early contact, pre-contact period and use that as a launching point. From there, there's Kevin Starr's written many great things about California that still hold up. I'm not a great writer. Again, if I were, I would be selling millions of books rather than hundreds of books. I've written over 50 titles and I still can't make a car payment out of them. But anyway, I'm working on it. I'm waiting till they come with want this to buy it for the script, the great script of the movie. I'm not sure who's going to be me, but I'll close on that. If you've ever seen the film The Presidio with Sean Connery, Sean Connery is the provost marshal, and of course, this old sergeant major, who's the Medal of Honor recipient, is the curator of the museum. Jack Warden isn't exactly me, and unfortunately, I don't have the Medal of Honor. But Jack Warden was also a crook, so I feel a little bit better. But part of the story revolves around a faux part of the Presidio Army Museum, which they film on the outside and then create some soundstage somewhere elsewhere, probably in Warner Brothers or what have you. So go watch the Presidio tonight. Have a dram of scotch in honor of Sean Connery. And we're going to do the same because Eileen and I just got back from Scotland last year at this time. So we'll probably sit down and have one and think about the Presidio and Sean Connery this afternoon.
To close, what are you working on next?
I'm privileged to work with a great group of folks at actually a city park in San Angelo, Texas called Fort Concho. And it really is one of those areas that delves heavily into the interaction between the native peoples of West Texas and particularly the African-American soldiers there. So I'm doing a little Arcadia book as a team, part of a team with that. And then after that, I'm writing a history of the 9th Cavalry, which was the regiment that Charles Young served with when he was at the Presidio and became the first Black superintendent of a national park. So that's the only of the four Buffalo Soldier regiments that doesn't have a regimental history. So I'm trying to fast track that because as you can, your readers and listeners can't tell, I'm a little older than I was when I was at the Presidio 50 years ago.
John, this has been a lot of fun. Again, the book is called Bastion by the Bay, The Presidio of San Francisco from Outpost of Empire to Magnificent Park. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Thanks, Jordan. Come out and visit when you can, but not until about March because the weather is horrendously hot right now.
Thanks for listening, everyone. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider supporting us by either giving us a rating and review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/historyofcalifornia. We'll see you next time.